This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. James DeTrost, first over to you. So we have midterm elections. What do you think? They say it's going to be all about the economy, since Americans are dealing with inflation and high living costs. How much do you think the vote is going to be about that or about the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think those two things go together. The fact that we have a totally incompetent president that's visible for the entire world to see, plus a very bad economic situation and inflation by all accounts, should mean a fairly decent night for the Republicans. And not only would the Republicans certainly take the House of Representatives, but very likely would take the Senate at all. But I think there are a lot of signals being sent, particularly by the Democrats, that that may not happen. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't sound like a man who expects to do badly in these elections. Rather than making his pitch to the American people, rather a few days ago, he went out and essentially threatened them and saying that if people don't accept the results of these elections, they're basically fascists, or one of his officials was speaking to Congress and saying essentially they would be agents of the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians if they don't accept the elections because they're fascists. It's very, very strange that somebody who by all rights should be expecting to do badly in an election is in a position of threatening his political opponents as, in essence, foreign agents and traitors if they question the election results. And I think we're already seeing some indications, for example, in the Senate race in Pennsylvania, which, again, by all rights, the Republican Mehmet Oz should win, that Mr. Fetterman, his opponent, the lieutenant governor, who's you know, again, makes even Joe Biden look like a competent person, is saying that he expects the Republicans to have a really good turnout today, but over the next days or even weeks, that he expects to come out on top. So I think there's a lot of very interesting and concerning signals that are being sent.
What do you think about what our guest there from Belgrade, James Utras, is saying there, Richard Becker, in terms of how Joe Biden has said what he said? I'm sure you heard him. What do you think that means?
Well, I don't really agree with that. I mean, I'm not a supporter of Joe Biden, but I don't think Biden was threatening to manipulate the election results. I think that has been the Republican strategy over a long period of time, is to put people into place, such as secretaries of state, which there's a secretary of state in each state of the United States, and they are responsible in most cases for running elections. The Republican strategy has been to get people into those positions who have taken the position that the 2000 election was illegal, that it was not, the outcome was manipulated, and so forth. So, I mean, the problem with Biden and the Democrats is that they have they've squandered their opportunity to a very large degree. They have, since the Democrats took control of the House and Senate as well as the White House in the 2000 election or following the 2000 election, they have failed to do what they said that they were going to do. They failed to carry out a program that could have really won them the support.
Why do you think that happened?
An unbeatable majority. And they, because instead of being able to carry through that agenda, they focused on things like Russiagate, so-called, I mean, these kind of ridiculous things, and that they have, as a party, are so divided among themselves that they have been unable to pass the program that had been proposed to relieve the suffering and meet the needs of the people.
Well, when you say a party that's divided, and you talk about how they've had their chance, and that now there's a missed opportunity because, as you mentioned, the focus on Russia, what issues are they divided on that stands out so glaringly. So as you, for you to say that, I mean, in that respect, then this party, even if they retain the House or Congress, they're not going to be able to move forward that well if what you're saying is true.
Well, you know, what they're not divided on is war. The so-called Progressive Caucus in Congress, in a very mild statement a few weeks ago, where they first of all said that they were they praised Biden and the White House and the Pentagon for pouring weaponry into to Ukraine to carry out what is really a U.S.-NATO proxy war against Russia, and they said, well, maybe we should have negotiations too, and they were attacked by their leaders of their own party, and these are all Democrats. They were attacked by the leaders of their own party for even suggesting that there should be negotiations instead of all-out military campaign until victory.
Sure.
At the cost of every, unlimited numbers of Ukrainian and Russian lives.
Sure. Well, this notion of democracy is something that the U.S. President Joe Biden said on the eve of the U.S. midterms, and the statement that he made is, we know in our bones that our democracy is at risk. And we know that this is your moment to defend it. So let me, James Atras is back. James Atras, Joe Biden's statements about democracy, how it's, we know in our bones that that it's at risk. And it kind of goes along with what you said, James Atras. But you would think that the stance that you made, if I'm interpreting it correctly, is something that the Republicans would kind of say, alluding to voter fraud, I'm guessing, based on some of the statements. How do you see the statement by Joe Biden vis-a-vis, of course, the Republican stance altogether?
Well, I took it as a threat. You see, here's what the paradox is that Biden is calling his enemies extremists in every respect. And the fact of the matter is, even if most Republicans think this, wrongly or rightly, even if most Republicans think there was corruption in this election and the election was stolen, just as many of them think that the 2020 election was stolen, Republicans are not going to go out on the street and burn things down the way Democratic supporters burned the country down in 2020 during the BLM riots. So there's this interesting paradox where one side engages in violence and has no consequences for it. The other side doesn't engage in violence, but is treated as enemies of the people. We've seen, for example, the politicization of the FBI and of the justice system to basically take care, to treat opponents of the Biden regime as enemies. And I think, as you started the program, this is an indication of just how polarized this country has become. But the fact of the matter is, one side is using violence and using the politicization of the law enforcement structures of the federal government against its political opponents. The other side,
which side?
To have no way to really deal with that.
Which side is doing that, James Atras?
I think the left is doing that. The Biden regime and its supporters are doing that against their opponents.
Richard Brecker, I see you shaking your head. It's interesting that James Atras says the Biden regime, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there were, after the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, there were demonstrations in more than 5,000 cities and towns in the United States. Less than 0.01% of those had any kind of violence, and there was no violence that ended up with people dead except at the hands of the police. And so now, on January 6th, that was not the left that stormed the Congress. That was the right wing, and led by fascist forces like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. They played a key role in that. I mean, this is your other guest is presenting a new falsification of history. And the reality of it is that the violence that's being threatened now is violence that's coming from the right. And it's people out like today in Arizona with automatic weapons at polling places intended to intimidate people and prevent them from voting. That's happening in many places across the country. That's what's the real threat of violence is coming from the fascists.
James Ross, go ahead.
Well, this is a perfect example of what you're talking about at the beginning of this program. Americans simply do not live in the same country anymore. We have a very polarized society where we are effectively morally aliens to one another, if not enemies. And there's nothing that's going to change that through an electoral process. And the fact of the matter is, I have to dispute what my opponent says. the 2020, during those mostly peaceful riots that burnt out the middle of many American cities, about 60 people died, and they were not killed by the police, who basically allowed them to do whatever they wanted to do in Democratic-controlled cities. Only one person died on January 6th, and that was an unarmed woman shot by a policeman.
Richard Becker.
You know, again, here you have a mass movement, the largest mass movement in U.S. history. 34 to 35 million people participated in those protests, and they were not riots. They were protests against police brutality.
They were riots, and by
that's
the way, the police did not kill George Floyd.
And you can't change
that.
He was a
criminal who died of a fentanyl overdose. Everybody knows this.
Richard Becker.
Oh, really? It wasn't the knee on the throat.
No, because he was saying I can't breathe while he was still standing up and not getting in the police car. He's saying I can't breathe while he was standing there. Somebody who can't breathe is not saying I can't breathe.
Okay, so we're seeing right now the breakdown amongst you two to be representative. I'm guessing a mirror image of what many Americans think about each other. And it's interesting that you say it's not that James Atrasi said that you were living amongst the aliens in the States, as you mentioned, but you're living in another planet. How did it get to the point where the polarization is not so much an exchange of thoughts as what many polls are indicating that this has to involve some kind of violence? And the reference is being made to the most recent incident that happened with Nancy Pelosi's husband. I mean, where does that line get crossed where violence comes into the picture in the States in this case?
It's clearly the right
who
is
that directed at?
I'm sorry. This is for James Atrasi. Richard Becker, I'm sorry. I'm going to come to you with that same question. James Atrasi, go ahead.
Well, I think let's take this Pelosi thing for an example. All the indications we've seen is that this unhinged gentleman who was caught in this very odd situation with Mr. Pelosi was some kind of a LGBT nudist activist of some sort, very much on the left wing if he had any politics at all. He seems to be a rather flaky individual. What kind of relationship, if any, he had with Mr. Pelosi, I don't know. Yet this is somehow being turned into by the mainstream media, which is essentially regime media that's in the pocket of the big corporations that, oddly enough, left-wing people in this country now support because it supports all their rainbow, homosexual, transgender agenda, which they want to impose on this country and, let's be honest, on the rest of the world. That somehow we've got woke capitalism in a kind of a fascist relationship with a left-wing regime that wants to suppress the American people, who are mostly passive, are not doing anything, are not threatening violence, but are being accused of being violent extremists.
You know, there's some points
that's
of views there. Thank you, James
Atrasi.
Richard Becker, some points of views there that James Atrasi has relayed, from LGBTQs to, if I said that correctly in that order, to the other opinions that he just said. And again, these are things that he said, that the left-wing regime, I guess, is what you said, is being exercised on the Americans. Do you feel that way? Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. And the person who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband was a left-wing conspiracy theorist, of who they are, who evolved into a right-wing, an extreme right-wing a conspiracy theorist. And that's why he carried out the attack that he did. And that's why he carried out what he was hoping would be an attack on Nancy Pelosi. And again, I'm not a supporter of Nancy Pelosi or the Democratic Party, but I think that there's no question that that's what happened. And this idea
right.
that there's a homosexual agenda is complete. That's a theory that has no
Richard
basis
Becker, quick question. Why isn't anybody for Nancy Pelosi? It seems like that's something that's been going on for quite some time.
Well, she has her supporters. As I said, I'm not a Democrat, but there are, you know, there's a very large Democratic Party that does support Nancy Pelosi. And the person who attacked her and who sought to attack her and did attack her husband
right.
Was not from the left. He was a person who had been persuaded by these conspiracy theories that somehow there was this agenda that was going on, and it was meant to turn everyone into pedophiles or something. I mean, it's complete garbage. It's just ridiculous garbage. But mm-hmm. that's what's being passed around as a real political outlook.
James Atrasi, go ahead if you have a reaction.
Yeah. It's a conspiracy. Huh? Just Google drag queen story hour. Just Google family-friendly drag queen shows and seeing what's being normalized in American schools, telling kids that they should dress up or transition, as they say, into another sex. This is being supported by the Biden regime. I do call it a regime, by the corporations. And this is America's agenda abroad. This is what we're trying
percentage?
To force on countries. We talk about countries like Ukraine, for example, talking about countries in Eastern Europe, in Serbia, where I am at the moment. This is the kind of agenda that this sick regime is trying to push on the American people and on the rest of the world. And a lot of ordinary Americans don't like it. And my only complaint is, we don't know what to do about it because we're talking about honest, law-abiding people, family people, married people with kids, church-going people who don't like these kind of values.
James Atrus, when you say that, what percentage, if you were to take a guess, unless you know a solid fact from a source, does America fall into the lines that you just said that are for or against what you said?
Well, see, that's the trouble. I think we don't really know. I think, unfortunately, it basically breaks down to about half and half with more extreme elements on either side. I would say more people on the right side are basically just sort of normal people who just want to live their lives and not accept this agenda. Is that a majority of the population? Probably not anymore. Maybe 35, maybe 40% of the population, but maybe another 10 or 20% will vote along with them. Same thing on the other side. I'm sure you have some very radical fringe on the left that espouses all of these values, but another 30, 40% of the population will vote along with them because they think they're voting for compassion or tolerance or any of these things. But the bottom line to me is that which side is the big money and the political power on? It's on the side of the left.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things there, Richard Becker, obviously that James Atrus said, I'm sure would not fly in San Francisco. But since we just have a few minutes left over here, let's move on to the foreign policy arena and see what's going to happen there. I mean, if all indications come out to be true in terms of the Republicans taking control of the Senate or the House or both, what are we looking at when it comes to, for example, hot button issues like Iran?
Well, unfortunately, there is a bipartisan foreign policy of the United States, and it's an imperialist foreign policy. And so we have Trump having, in regard to Iran, having shut down, walked out of the JCPOA unilaterally, really a violation of that treaty. We have Trump having increased the imposition of sanctions, 243 new sanctions on Cuba, causing great suffering to the people. It's increasing the sanctions on Iran, doing the same thing. But then you have Biden, who when he was running, said he was going to change those policies, and he has not. So there's no new JCPOA. There's still sanctions on Iran. There's a maintenance of the sanctions blockade against Cuba. And there is a foreign policy that is getting bipartisan support for the U.S.-NATO proxy war against Russia, a war that really threatens the whole world with nuclear destruction, and a war that needs to come to an end, and can only come to an end not based on a decision by Zelensky, who I think is the president of Ukraine, who I think is just a puppet, but it's the refusal of the U.S. and NATO to negotiate, going all the way back to last year, when there was an opportunity for that, and instead has fueled this war. And that's a Republican and Democratic joint project.
Keep hearing about Republicans, James Atrus, that are going to tone down the aid, military aid or assistance overall, perhaps, to Ukraine. Are we really looking at that happening? Were they to take control?
No, I don't think so. And this is where I do agree with my colleague on the program, is that we do have two warmongering parties. And even though I think there will be more Trump-type mega populists who are being demonized by the other side, they're really the only ones that might be somewhat opposed to some of this stuff, but even they will be a tiny minority in the Republican office holders. The leadership will be even more warmongering than the Democrats are. And of course, the left wing of the Democratic Party that used to be a peace wing of the Democratic Party has totally collapsed. We had that fiasco a few weeks ago where a number of left wing members, you know, the progressive bloc in the House had written urging, just mildly urging negotiations, and were forced to retract it because their betters in the party, I guess, held them down. So it's really sad. We have some populist right opposition to these things, but it's very small, and it's not really going to have much of an impact. My only fear is that the Republicans take the Congress, and that they'll simply demand even more money for Ukraine, more militancy in global affairs. So unfortunately, I think my colleagues he and I agree on this.
Okay. Final question. I see we have some time here. I'm going to go back to you had a UN special rapporteur say back in the year 2020, where he decried near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights. Richard Becker, electoral laws in some part of the U.S., like Texas, may undermine democracy by depriving millions of citizens the equal right to vote. Are we going to look at that happen perhaps this time, or is this a norm, or what do you think about this? Again, this was something that came out based on a report back in 2020.
It's very widespread, and it's aimed at particularly at black voters, also Latino voters, to restrict their access to voting. After years of trying to of expanding the access, now there have been in many states restrictions that have been put into place. And I think this is because the right wing can't really win the elections anymore if everyone gets to vote. And you know who said that? Donald Trump. He said that a few years ago. He said, if we let everybody vote, the Republicans will never win another election. So the strategy is, let's shut down voting rights. Let's make voting more difficult. Why does voting even take place in the United States on a Tuesday, today? Why not and why isn't it a national holiday? So because it makes it so much more difficult.
Let me give 30 seconds to James Jatras. James Jatras, in closing, anything you'd like to say?
I would agree with my colleague on moving elections from Tuesday to a Saturday or a Sunday. If people agree with me that people to register to vote must not only provide proof of their identity, but proof of their citizenship, which simply does not happen. What he talks about, what ballot security measures are designed to make sure that people who are voting are actually citizens of the United States and actually who they are, who they say they
Thank
are.
You.
Instead, what we get is the massive dumping of mail-in ballots, which is an open recipe for fraud.
Thank you, James Jatras, former U.S. diplomat from Belgrade. Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist, Answer Coalition, San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the effects of faith. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the effects of faith in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Allah has said in the Quran that أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَتْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبِ, that let it be known with the remembrance of Allah there is a peace for the hearts. Therefore, the person who is a true believer, who is a faithful person, he has peace in his life. He never panics. He never gets upset for anything because he has patience in his life. Therefore, the one of the major effects or positive effects or advantages that we can see for being a faithful to reach to the level of iman is that the one who is faithful, he avoids the moral vices. So he avoids the moral vices. And this is one of the important things, that a person who is faithful, because this faith is connected to the ethics, believing becomes a believer, become a faithful, it is necessary that this person should follow the moral values. He is someone who is submissive to the moral values of Islam. Therefore, he avoids the moral vices. He avoids anything that is immoral, Therefore, he goes after the ethics, he goes after the moral values, and he tries to apply them in his life. When he's applying that in his life, therefore, other people can see moral values from him, and they also start following him. The way we started to follow the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because that was full of the moral values. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the effects of faith in the Islamic lifestyle. Therefore, we mentioned another effect that one of the effects and the advantages of the faith is that a person who is faithful, who gets the level of Iman, he avoids the moral vices. Therefore, when a mu'min, a true believer, when he sees himself in a place that there are moral vices, he avoids them. And the major issue today that we see in the society is that we see immoral values in the people. For example, lying is no more a bad thing in the society. Parents easily lie in front of kids and they learn from them. Parents very easily perform some immoral actions or deeds in front of kids, and the kids learn them. In the schools, we have seen that the importance of the moral values have become, it's become dim. Why? Because the children, the students at the school, they no more respect teacher the way they used to do. They no more respect the older or old age people the way they used to do. They do not respect each other the way they used to do. They do not care, or they do not care about each other the way they used to do. So all these things have come. Why? Because today we see that people, they just think about themselves. And Islam says that this is not the way you need to live. The way you need to live is to give importance to the others, to adopt the moral values, to avoid the moral vices in the society. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam also said that al-mu'minu, a believer, true believer, is man tahhara qalbahu, who purifies his heart from min ad-daniyya, who purifies his heart from the evil things, from immoral things, from the things that has no value in the life of the humans. Therefore, we must also be careful, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases, but it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aids if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses, and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy.
The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Emirzadeh, Kabul.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs three different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan blocked the key avenues and roads leading towards country's capital Islamabad, causing massive traffic jams, halting logistics, and forcing schools and offices to close. Khan, who is demanding immediate elections, survived the assassination attempt last Thursday in the eastern Punjab province, leaving him wounded along with his several party workers. Police have arrested the suspected shooter and registered a case against him. However, Imran Khan and his supporters are not satisfied with it, demanding that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a senior military official be investigated through a UN inquiry for their alleged involvement in the attack.
There's only one national leader whose name is Imran Khan. Everybody is behind him. We want free and fair investigation under United Nations investigation force.
The masses on the streets were irked due to the violent protest and road closures, asking authorities to end what they call the ongoing drama.
We are sick of such protest and unrest. Our lives and properties are not safe. Political parties should resolve their issues in the parliament instead of disturbing our lives on the streets.
While apologizing the masses over the current political uncertainty in the country, the government asked the PTI-led provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces to play their role in opening the roads to ease the life of the masses.
I apologize to the people affected by Imran Khan's long march and protests on behalf of the federal government. We strongly requested the provincial governments to open the national highways immediately.
Khan's party has announced that its anti-government march will be resumed on Thursday at the place where Khan was attacked.
The recent attack on former Pakistani Prime Minister has deepened the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Petra Bas Lip is the mother of Alina Lip, a journalist whom the German government is trying to imprison due to her reporting in Donbass. Like her daughter, she has fled Germany to Crimea due to persecution. The government recently arbitrarily closed her bank account.
First her bank account, then her father's bank account, and last mine. So, yeah.
And what does that do, closing down your bank account?
What does it... You must imagine, you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So, what to do?
And the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case, they didn't even tell you, they just shut it down?
No, they didn't tell me. No, nothing.
How did you survive?
Yeah, I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So the state told you that? The state told you to go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lip for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
As they see Elena as an enemy of their narrative, her message as a threat, they want to make Elena's move impossible by blocking the financial capability and creating a psychological pressure. They are distorting her focus out from the things what she were doing before, and I mean seeking the truth and telling the truth to the German audience, and that is their target. And when they are succeeding of disturbing her job, then they think that they are winning the battle.
Yes, I think that the governments in Europe, because I'm not the only case, prosecute the parents of journalists, because we, of course, get support of our parents. They support us maybe also. It's the fact that if they close my bank account, probably the parents will help out. For me, it's an act of a suppressive state, or even terror state. I don't know what's going on in Germany now.
While WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange languishes in a British jail, and French journalist Adrien Bouquet recently survived an assassination attempt in Turkey, he suspects, by the Ukrainian SBU, for Alina and her mother, it's exile. The threat to Western journalists who challenge the mainstream with uncomfortable truths is growing. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
England and Wales football associations are pushing ahead with plans to peddle political messages at this year's World Cup football tournament hosted by Qatar. In a joint statement with 8 other European federations, England and Wales insisted they will continue to press off-field issues in spite of a FIFA plea to focus on football.
National teams and their players choosing this sporting event to push their Western worldview so blatantly onto the Arab world is unprecedented, creating a culture war at an event which is supposed to remain free from politics.
Doha has come under fire for its human rights record, including poor treatment of migrant workers who built the competition's infrastructure. But the criticism also goes further, with activists attacking Qataris over their religious and cultural beliefs too, such as bans on alcohol, premarital relations, and Western LGBTQ culture. However, onlookers from the Muslim world have been less impressed by the anti-Qatar bandwagon.
We obviously know that they're very hypocritical, and, for example, on the Ukraine issue, basically politics is coming to sport, you know, when the West feels like it. But the West cannot have it its own way all the time. And this is a World Cup, the first World Cup in an Arab and Muslim country. They need to go there and respect the culture. Muslim sportsmen coming to the West do not necessarily, they don't insist that the West stops invading foreign countries before playing sport, or prohibit gambling and, you know, pornography and all this kind of stuff which is prevalent in the West, you know, because we realize that different countries have different cultures. And when you go to somebody else's country, you obey the law and you respect the country, you respect the local culture. And if you don't like it, you leave.
This is the first time that the World Cup has ever been hosted in the Middle East. Qatar's authorities have promised to provide a welcoming environment to all. This week, Doha's foreign minister responded angrily to what he called European arrogance and double standards. Many expect that activists on and off the pitch will stage protests throughout the competition. How Qatari authorities will police this remains to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Hamirzad, Kabul.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Gio Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark, but 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Gio Barents were told to stay on board.
that was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding to disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week, when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the causes why people are forced to migrate. So when we tell this story, when we try to approach, when we try to unveil these realities, what is happening in the concentration camp in Libya, people will wake up.
Since the start of the year, about 180,000 asylum seekers have reached the EU on boats, up almost 90% compared to the year before. We are in the middle of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of World War II, and as distasteful as it may sound, that's also a huge business opportunity. An increasing number of people believe that refugee flows keep pouring into the old continent for the greed of those who exploit asylum seekers for profit in and outside Europe. Max Civili, Rome.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. This is Arab English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita, and I would love them to introduce themselves.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma, and all the listeners. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in English Language Teaching, TEFL.
So great. And you, Sister
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And actually, I have the pleasure to be here today with you too, my dear friends, and also our dear listeners here. It's a big pleasure for me. So I'm Bita, and I'm a medical student at Sheikh Bashir University. And also, I'm here at your service for today's discussion.
Well, as human beings, we cannot claim, I guess there's no one who could claim that I have never committed a sin unless they're holy people or they are infallible people. Aside from those people, the rest of humankind would do terrible things. They sometimes get out of the track and they go for sins. They commit sins and they know that it's going to pollute their soul, yet they go for it. Now, what happens when I commit a sin?
When you commit a sin, there are two possibilities that might happen to you. Mm-hmm. One of them is that you might not realize that you are disobeying God. You might not realize that you are doing a bad thing. And you, in fact, you are doing something haram. That is the reason for forgetting about this act is the negligence.
So you mean that we do not have a right conception of the sin itself?
Yes, we might forget about that.
Yeah.
For example, backbiting is something haram, but we might not realize that we are backbiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking to you about some person and I just don't realize that I'm saying bad things about him or her.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. And that might be due to, as I said, negligence. Negligence, and you might not realize what you're doing. You might forget about that. But the other possibility is that you realize that you are disobeying God, and so you won't enjoy whatever you are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you're backbiting, you're laughing at your friend, humiliating somebody, yes.
Poking fun at others.
Yes, you are doing all of this. But when you realize or when you know that you are just disobeying God, that would seize your moments of enjoyment.
Yeah.
No matter which possibility are you from, which group are you from, that, you know, our sister told us, there is an absolute answer to the sin. You know, there is a beautiful verse in Holy Quran that tells us, whoever commits a sin commits it only against himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Allah is all-knowing and all-wise. When you do commit a sin, you know, you are doing something wrong. It doesn't matter if at that time you think you're doing something correct. For example, there are situations that you think if you lie about, I don't know, an issue, it's somehow beneficial for you. But mm-hmm. It's not like that, actually, at a whole time.
It is beneficial for a short time.
For a short time, exactly. Yeah. And this is the problem, because you have to see the whole, actually, conclusion of something, of an action.
Yeah.
So there are two things. First of all, you have to understand that you cannot just see the time you are at. You have to look at the future, the past, and so many other things. And the other thing is about our conscience.
Exactly.
You know, when you commit a sin, no matter how enjoyable that sin would be, for example, like drinking alcohol or something, that may soothe your problems at a time. But after a long time, it's like I'm running from something, and that thing is your true self.
Yeah,
and that's it's your conscience.
But then, sister, you know, there's something. It happens that we see plenty much of people who are doing a wrong thing for a long time and they do not feel it. How about them?
I think here it could be two problems, actually. First of all, there are some people who don't know that they are committing a sin, as my sister just told us.
Also, we have plenty much of people who know that they're they're fully aware of what they're doing.
In that case, I think somehow this is their habit. You know, when a scene comes to habit, it's bigger than any other thing.
So when you leave a scene go on, then it would turn into a habit. It would be habit formation that you made it out of a scene.
In a religion, there is a big sin.
Yeah.
And it is that when you think that your sin is not that much big.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. And in that case, you will commit it again and again and again. There is no end for that. And you think, okay, it doesn't have much matter, for example. Okay, let's do that.
Yeah.
It's not. And this is a sin, actually.
Yeah.
Itself. And this is so important. I think this is the root of all the sins here that are repeated.
There is a nice point of view that comes from the mystical perspective. They say that do not look at the sin you have done, be it a small one or a big one. Look at the fact that you are disobeying your loved one.
Yeah.
This is very beautiful. If we just consider this fact that what I'm doing is just breaking the borders that my Lord has been put for me, and then he would be dissatisfied with me. This is going to hurt us, really. So we would never go for the sins. We talked about the fact that maybe temporarily we would feel happy for the things that we have done, and maybe it would have some benefits for us. But still, there comes this point that what are the consequences of the sin to our souls? But before that, let me just ask you and the audience to go for a short break, and we'll be back in no time. Thank you, dear listeners. Welcome back, dear listeners, sisters, and brothers. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, in here we're talking about sins and what happens after we commit a sin. and the mood that is going to get to us through the things that we make. Well, we were talking about the consequences